Yes, that's right. That's right. Familiar tune, a familiar podcast. We are back second time this week because we're giving you exactly what you guys wanted. Exactly what you guys wanted. My name is Joe.
And I'm Carolyn.
You guys are listening to Carolyn and Joe! Carolyn and Joe Show. My name is Joe Carabin. I'm a filmmaker, photographer, a writer, definitely in the band Monday Mistress. But today I am a podcaster, and across from me is one of the greatest creators, cartoonists, universally super talented people in this whole entire world. If you don't know her, you should know her. Her name is Karen Bilewski. How's it going, Carolyn?
How's it going, Joe? It's going good over
How's it going? That's right. This song is absolutely perfect. If you guys don't know, it belongs to many things, but world famous to me and probably to you, it goes to the movie Pulp Fiction. Because you know what? What are we doing today?
We are doing our AwesomeCon recap with the live show of Phil LaMarr.
That's right.
So we had this awesome opportunity to do an actual live podcast of the Carolyn and Joe Show with special guest Phil LaMarr just this past week. We did it on June 3rd, 2016. I was like, whoa, we're going in the past.
2016,
this
baby.
Music's taking me back.
That's right.
Yeah.
I get a little trouble sometimes, too. I still drop the 15, the 14, the 13, 11, but it's really the 16.
Yes, 2016. That is the year that we are living in right now.
Absolutely.
And Phil LaMarr was amazing. Not only was he in Pulp Fiction, but geez, he's been in so many things. He's been in Foster's Home. He's been in Mad TV. He's worked with Paul Reubens. You know, the usual. He's
the
just,
usual.
You know, he's just an awesome dude. So let's stay together.
So it's really great. First of all, I really wanted to thank AwesomeCon, you know, all the people that put that thing together.
Definitely.
like, you know, Ben, of course, one of the top guys. He's on this podcast many times. He's a great person. He's absolutely a great person, hardworking, but also everyone else behind the scenes, you know, Becky putting the panels together, everyone, every single person for giving us
and all
this
of the
opportunity,
brute squad.
The brute squad, every single person that put together that show. I personally want to say thank you for giving us this opportunity every single year. I hope we can continue to do this every single year. I have a blast doing it. I believe Carolyn has a blast doing it too.
I mean, yeah. Why would I not? It's AwesomeCon.
It's AwesomeCon.
Everything is awesome at AwesomeCon.
But we have Phil LaMarr on the Carolyn Joe Show. It was live in front of an audience. And actually, what's crazy is that this room that we did the panel is the biggest room. Every single year, the Carolyn
Joe
Show, it was the biggest room that Carolyn and Joe Show has done it in. So that part was pretty, it was a little bit intimidating. Because, you know, every year...
I wasn't nervous.
Well, intimidating is, you know...
I mean, I want the room to be full.
And it was pretty awesome. So we got a pretty damn good reaction. I was really excited. And also, I didn't go in with a plan. I was just like, let's just talk to Phil. Because the very first AwesomeCon, we met Phil.
Yeah. He's been at every single AwesomeCon.
Yeah.
So there's been four so far, and he's been there every year. He's like a mainstay.
Yeah. So the overall impression I got from having such a grand conversation with Phil LaMarr on this, you know, it's the same thing with whenever any of us try to do any type of interview with anybody, we want to get that exclusive. We want to bring something new to the interview that hasn't been done before. I don't know if you do, but like to me, I always try to do that with a little bit of dabbling of like, okay, we know you came from this. It's almost like whenever we do an interview, it's like, okay, it's for the people that in a way that pay attention. You know what I mean? If that makes any sense, it's sort of like we know Phil LaMarr. We know the Wikipedia. We know the shows beyond that. But then we always like to say like, but there's a story. There's a real story or there's a real person behind that. And the Carolyn and Joe Show is always aimed to get the real, you know, to bring the realness. And I think
we like the deep cuts.
Yeah, the deep cuts, but also like the honest, the stuff that you can't really hear on like, say, like a fluff piece or something like that. And which is what's great about having a podcast like we do and being able to critique life. So it's almost like we critiqued life with Phil LaMarr. And I thought it was amazing. We brought up a lot of stuff that you guys will probably be surprised that we even brought up at all, or even like discovered. It was actually a panel of discovery, if you think about it. Or at least for me, it was.
So let's get to it. You guys are going to enjoy this. This is the live Carolyn and Joe Show with special guest Phil LaMarr, live from AwesomeCon 2016. Enjoy.
Hey.
Thank you.
script here.
Yeah.
All right.
Hello.
He has arrived. So Joe, let's start this thing.
So just so you guys know if you're in the right place, my name is Joe.
And I'm Carolyn.
You guys are here for the Carolyn Joe Show with
Phil Lamar, live at AwesomeCon 2016.
So now, is this going to record you through the mics?
Yes.
Or
it's going to record
you being recorded by the mics?
It's
recorded.
Us, everything up here. So some stuff that we do up here, they might not know. So we're just, yeah.
We do a lot of sign language.
We can do a little of this thing. There was a second where I thought you were going to be here, so you just made me cry.
No.
But I knew you knew about it, because we were online.
Exactly.
And you knew.
I just tweeted you, I'm on my way. Yeah, we got stuck downstairs.
Understandably.
It was absolutely dead quiet until 5 minutes to 6.
That's how it is. People getting out of work. Friday, that's how it is at conventions, always the late rush.
You know what's great is that, like, I feel like at this point in AwesomeCon, Phil, that you are pretty much, like, part of AwesomeCon royalty, because you've been here since, like, the beginning, I feel like.
I've been here since AwesomeCon 1, which was crazy because it's so well organized that it did not feel like a first-year con, because most of the time a first-year con feels like a first-year con.
Yeah.
Like, the people running it don't know what they're doing. The people coming don't know what they're doing. Like, nobody knows what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you should wear a costume. What? No, just dress up like a character. Oh, yeah. In my second year, it's like, look at me, I've got horns. I made them myself.
Now, was conventions, was that something you did when you were younger? Did you go to conventions? Did you hit any of those things?
Joe, there weren't conventions when I was younger. Conventions are what dentists went to. It's like, I'm going to St. Paul for a convention, dear. No, conventions existed pre-internet, but it was the deepest fandoms. It was Star Trek.
Yeah.
And, you know, the really, really small groupings of comic fans, you know. Like, I mean, you know, you look at the old pictures of the original San Diego Comic-Con, where it's like, there are 8 tables. You know, and
with
Stan Lee
fantastic.
Is sitting in one of them, and Jim Shooter's at the other one.
Yeah,
you know.
And they didn't even have big displays or anything. It was just straight up
folding
table.
No. They were sharing the room with a bunch of dentists. You know,
that's when I started hearing about conventions. Really, with you had Star Trek, you had some Star Wars, but really for me, it came with Hercules and Xena. I don't know if you ever got into Hercules and Xena, but they had heavy ass conventions.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, but was that the early internet or pre-internet?
That was. When was the internet for you? When did that start? Was that like mid-90s? When was that? When did the internet start for you?
When did you smell the internet? I'm trying to think. Because I remember, I remember the first personal computer.
Yeah.
Like second semester freshman year.
With Carmen Sandiego on it and stuff?
Carmen Sandiego. No, dude, there were no graphics on it. It was a blinking green cursor. On my freshman year roommate was very well to do, and came back from Christmas break with a computer in our room.
Whoa.
It's like, you mean you don't have to go to the computer center, the computer lab, and wait in line to print out your paper on a dot matrix printer? It's like, no, I have to do that to print a paper, but I can write the paper here in our room. And it was one of these little boxy Macs where you had to put in the startup disk because there wasn't enough memory for both the startup program and whatever word processing or math program you wanted to do. So like you put one in, and now it's running. I mean, basically it was like starting a Flintstone car.
Uh-huh.
Like once you like run your feet and it starts rolling, then you can jump on and now I'm gonna start typing.
And don't forget that big cartoon steak.
Yes, exactly.
You need to have that always on your car.
With the Ring of Fire.
Yeah.
Well, that was the Mac 2.
Nice. Well, things have totally progressed since then, and there's no way anyone would have patience for that.
No. You guys have no idea.
So how do you like D.C.? I saw this morning that you went to the White House.
Yes.
How was that?
That was amazing. It was...
Was that your first time actually inside the House?
In the House of White?
The House of White.
Sort of. And it's... When
have
I say
you been
sort
before?
Of,
have you been on the lawn only?
Well, now here's the thing. I haven't ever been to the White House, but I've been in several of the rooms.
Okay.
because earlier this year I did several episodes of Veep.
Okay.
And they like meticulously recreated all of these rooms in the White House. In fact, today I tweeted out to my friend Dave Mandel, who's the producer of Veep. I'm like, here are two pictures. Which of them is the real Red Room and which of them is yours?
Love it.
Guess. Hint, yours is the one with Julia Louis-Dreyfus in it.
So they've done a great job with the set dressing then. Yeah,
really great job. And it's funny because it was like total deja vu. I'm like, oh my God, I've been in this room.
You're like, I'm at work.
Only it didn't have a ceiling.
Man, that's so cool.
I think that's really cool when you get those opportunities to be like, you know, when you're sort of, you know, like a guest, and you're like, right. Now I get to go to the Taj Mahal because I'm doing this.
Exactly.
What is doing conventions? Has that taken you to like amazing places and that you've never thought you would go to?
Jacksonville. Sandusky, Ohio. All the great.
Yes.
This is the only one with a White House in it, though.
That's true.
I have to say.
Yeah.
It's funny because there were a bunch of us there. Billy West was there. John Barrowman was there. But they told us that Obama wasn't. Like, oh, he's in Denver. I'm like, oh. And I really had this, like, it's like, well, there are these big hallways. I wonder if I could just sort of, like, start talking and make people think, ladies and gentlemen, if I could just, like, start doing his voice and have people
turn around,
stick out, like, is he in our office? Is he here?
People, like, stop.
But then I thought someone might shoot me.
But why?
Because the security, well.
I mean, it's pretty secure.
Imposter! You know, aliens! You know, the Men in Black would come out.
That would be amazing. I really wish the Men in Black were real, but just being honest.
I'm not going to say if they are or not, because someone will come and erase my memory.
I know, right? And they'll be like, you know, a weather balloon. Just kidding.
Flew by. That's right. It's like, don't worry about it, ma'am.
So I'd like to really, like, I want to dig deep and just really get to know you, sir. We don't get to hang out as much like we used to back in the day.
Back in olden times. When this was the entire convention.
Yes.
You 78 people.
So really,
I would have been Stan Lee. I'm going to give everybody here a free Marvel comic. Excelsior.
We did give out free stuff. Did people get free stuff before?
What?
Yes.
I missed the free stuff?
Here, darn it. You can have a free Carolyn and Joe show exclusive.
What is it? Look at you with the merch.
Merch, baby.
Wow. And you didn't even make this yourself. I can tell.
It says, I made the logo, though. That kind of counts.
There you go. It's made in China. Okay.
It's hard to make pens yourself, I will say. I won't try that.
I wouldn't put it past you, though. You're a very creative person.
But I have made my own comics, but not pens. So speaking of comics and cartoons and the like, right. I hear you do voices.
I hear you do voices.
I hear that. I've heard your voices.
You're hearing voices?
Yeah.
Carolyn, is there something we should talk about?
Yeah, definitely. You don't want to be inside my brain. So, what are the new shows that you're working on now? Let's dive into the future before the past.
That is a good question. What are we working on? See, here's the problem I have with that question,
mm-hmm.
is there's such a huge lag time in American animation. It's usually 9 months to a year between when what I'm working on actually is visible. So when you ask me what I'm working on, you're not really asking me what I'm working on. You're asking me what I was working on a year ago.
Yes. What is out now that you have worked on?
Exactly. I think there's a bunch of the Marvel shows. The new Avengers show and Ultimate Spider-Man. I've been doing. It's fun actually. Ashley Eckstein and I, who worked together on Clone Wars, she did Ahsoka Tano, and I did Kit Fisto. We're actually working on Ultimate Spider-Man as Cloak and Dagger. Oh, did I?
Wait a minute.
Yeah. which is so much fun. It's fun to get to work with Ashley again, and also to work on Ultimate Spider-Man. Because it soothes the burn.
Because mm-hmm.
Basically, every time Disney buys something, I lose a job. We were working on Spectacular Spider-Man, created by Greg Weisman, who did Gargoyles and Young Justice. And it was a great show. It was so much fun. Disney bought Marvel, and the first thing they did was cancel Spectacular Spider-Man.
Well, you know what's interesting? Speaking of Spider-Man, I just want to jump in from your voice acting to your screen, mm-hmm. is that Joe and I were actually watching Spider-Man 2 randomly, and we were like, and we knew that we were going to be talking with you last week, and we were like, is that Phil Lamar?
Were we imagining it?
And I was
we
like,
projecting Phil's face on
the... It was like for like not even a full second, I don't think. And it was, and I was like, oh, what? Is that him? And it turns out, it is you.
Yes.
Was it really?
Yes. Yeah.
I didn't know.
It is.
I had a non-speaking role in Spider-Man 2.
Yes.
Which I think
so
is one of
that.
The greatest.
Great, no, it's one of the best superhero movies
it is.
Ever made.
The Tobey Maguire Spider-Man, I'm going to go down and straight up say, my favorite superhero movies.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to go all that way with it.
I'm just going to
I'm in it, and I'm not sure you want to go all that way.
Would you say that's your favorite just Spider-Man movies?
I'll say that's my favorite Spider-Man movies.
Okay, I'll buy you. I'll buy that.
Why, Phil? What do you have to say in retort to that?
No, because of the... I will say that Spider-Man 2 is one of the best, arguably, I don't know, there have been so many good ones lately.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's definitely one of the best superhero movies of all time. Spider-Man 3 taints the trilogy in such a humongous way.
I want to know why, from your perspective, why does it taint the trilogy?
Tobey Maguire can't dance.
See, I knew.
Is it always just the dance part? Is it always the dance?
No. That's just the worst part of the movie. But no, it has so many of the things that make studio superhero movies bad.
Yeah.
The fact that, well, it's Spider-Man 3. We must have three villains.
Throw them all in.
What? Why? Why can't you just have one good one?
And that, you know, from what I read from Sam Raimi or heard, it was supposed to be two movies. He wanted to make two movies off of that. And I would have loved that. But
yeah, I don't know. It was the first one was really pretty good, even though it was two separate movies. The first one, first one was an origin movie, and then a really good Green Goblin movie.
Yeah, it's always like, and now we're in New York,
right? Yeah. It's like, and now he's no longer a kid.
Yeah,
which is really what it should have been to start with. But somebody said you have to do an origin.
Yeah,
Sony. and then, but so the first one is good. The second one is fantastic. Toby is amazing, and Alfred Molina is the best superhero villain of a movie.
Yeah.
Period. I don't know. I'm still always. I wish Toby was a funnier Spider-Man.
In a third one, or just in general?
In general.
In general? He's more like he's a goofier Spider-Man?
No, I mean, I just don't buy him as funny. He's not funny.
Did you think
Spider-Man should be small and fast and funny.
What about Andrew Garfield? Did you like? I thought he was too cool. He was a cool guy.
Yeah.
He would get the ladies.
Right.
You know? He did get the ladies.
I bought him as smart. I bought him as funny. But yeah, not the he was a John Romita Spider-Man.
Yeah.
He was not a Steve Ditko Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Which I mean, I ain't gonna hate nobody for that. You know, some people just can't be Steve Ditko Spider-Man. Most of us can't be.
Yeah, it's funny because like I always bring up this point where people were commenting on saying like the worst part of Spider-Man 3 was the dancing, and then they, you know, then you get the director who has a whole dance sequence in 500 Days of Summer going into Spider-Man. I'm like, wait a minute, but then he's coming in. I'm okay with number two. I love number two. I absolutely love number two. I used to watch that in the back of my car in the cold weather in college to inspire me to be a filmmaker. I'm like, that's what I want to do.
Right, is do that.
There's something really nice and nostalgic about the Tobey Maguire movies for me. And maybe it was just the period of life where I was in. Mm-hmm. So I maybe it's just a personal thing, but I really...
It's in my heart. We all understand. There is that thing of seeing something through your youthful eyes. I have an unexplainable affection for the original Battlestar Galactica series. But I know better than to go back and try and watch it.
Yeah. It's like just let those memories live when you were younger.
Unless I can go back into a time machine and see, you know, put in my 12-year-old eyes, it's going to hurt.
So is there anything else that you were inspired by growing up that you were really into? And were you into geek culture? I guess because you're
Battlestar. I'm a comic book guy. I mean, I have to admit, my Battlestar thing was really just because I missed the boat on Star Wars. And this was a chance to like get in on the ground floor of the Star Wars for TV. Mm-hmm. Like, no, I've seen since the first episode. I did that with a lot of things. Like, I was never the person who got the first issue of something great when it first came out. So like, I would struggle to try to catch up. You know, I have the first issue of ROM Space Knight. which was really not
worth it. I don't even know what that is.
ROM Space Knight was a Marvel series that came out sometime in the 80s. Actually, that first issue came out at the exact same time as Moon Knight number one.
Okay.
Which, at least in retrospect, Moon Knight number one has some, you know, street value because it's early Bill Sienkiewicz, and when he was just like doing, you know, Neil Adams knockoffs.
Yeah.
It's so Neil Adams knockoff. It's hilarious. Like even with the like, you know, the grit, you know, the gritty like, you know, face.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have like 20 issues of ROM Space. I had a subscription, just. Because it was the first issue, like, no man, this is gonna be really cool, and I'm gonna say I had the first issue, and nope, not worth anything to anybody.
That sucks when that happens. I remember doing that, like, I got this first one, this number one, and then no one, like, I was never gonna sell it anyway. I was just tricking myself.
I know, that's the thing. You keep things like, no man, this could be worth something. It's like, and then what? Well, I don't know. I'll like, you know.
I remember I had to. Because instead of getting an allowance, or I did get an allowance for like lunch, mm-hmm. but I pitched to my mom, I'm just gonna just give me the money up front so I can buy comics. And then
instead of eat lunch?
Instead of eat lunch. No, I was hardcore about that. I can just bring a slice of bread and cheese. And that's it.
Did she go for this?
She went for that, but what I had to do, because I had to sell her on the fact of why comics are amazing. And I couldn't really sell her on the fact of like, yeah, because these characters and, you know, spandex right. and they go into space and wow. She had to know a business reason. So I had to pitch to her like, oh, if I buy like issue number one, and in 10 years, it's gonna be worth something. I went to the back of Wizard magazine and be like,
right,
look,
right.
look, see, these are worth like $20 now. She bought it, but guess how many comics I actually end up selling? Zero. Right.
Well, but also, that's hilarious that you sold that to your mom, because the engine that drives the value of comic book speculation is the fact that moms destroy them and throw them out.
Yeah.
So if your mom's on board, you've ruined the business model. You know?
That's a sacrifice. Do you still have any of your old comics? Do you have any of that stuff lying around?
Yeah, you know what? Puberty hit and I sold a bunch of them.
For what? There's always a serious reason, you
know? No. I have a Batman encyclopedia. I bought a couple of like history of comics books, which I still have, and I still have all my old Mad magazines. I have some Mad magazines that are older than I am.
Oh wow! So you actually got in on Mad before the TV show?
Yes, well before. No, I had there was a kid who lived next door to me. Actually, to me he was a grown up. It was when I was 12 or so. This guy was graduating college, and he came back from college one day and said, hey, do you read comics? And he gave me his childhood collection.
Wow.
You know, it wasn't super extensive, but I had, you know, I was exposed to comics far older than I otherwise would have been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had like 10 and 20 cent, you know, old comics, you know, from the late 60s, early 70s that he had when he was a kid. So it gave me a wider range to start from. And, you know, opened my eyes up to, like, the history of comics. I think that's why I wound up, you know, being really interested in, you know, all the old stuff, you know, and why I still know, you know, who Carmine Infantino was and, like, you know, have a deep appreciation for comic book artistry, you know.
So when we bring it back, you know, one of the first, you know, while I was really excited, not that you're not already an awesome person, but while I was really excited to talk to you, is that you are one of the most legendary scenes in a movie in my history of movies, in Pulp Fiction.
Ah, okay.
And I cannot get over sitting next to you and talking about that right now. That to me, when I was, you know, like it was on MTV. They had the parodies of like, you know, like the burger or the in the scene when you're in the car.
Big Kahuna Burger.
Yeah,
the Kahuna Burger.
What? The Kahuna Burger, yeah,
oh,
the Kahuna
Burger. Like those MTV interstitial things?
Well, you know, like the movie awards. They would play that in the movie awards.
Right.
And then
yes.
That scene to me, I think maybe it was in that summer, was always, always playing. How does it feel? When you were being part of that movie, how was that experience? Was that something that...
Oh, it was fantastic. I mean, it's funny. It was one of those things that I didn't know it was going to be like a huge success, but I knew it was going to be great. You know, because that's the thing. When you read a script that's that good, you know it's gonna be good. But quality is never, you know, necessarily a predictor of success. Certainly not in America.
No. Yeah.
But it was the best set like I've ever been on. It was just, Quentin treated everybody wonderfully, and that trickles down. Like, if the guy on the top is nice, then everybody else is nice.
Yeah.
You know, I came on to the movie probably 2 months or 2.5 months into a 3 month shoot. By that time, everybody's done. You know, the on-set affairs are over. People are all, you know, looking for their next job, and it starts to dissipate.
It's like camp.
Exactly.
Summer camp.
But on that set, people were still going out every Friday night. They pass, you know, Friday at 5, they pass out flyers. This is where we're going. You know, this is where we're going drinking tonight. And Travolta would show up.
Nice.
You know, like everybody was in it. You know, and it's a rare thing. And then for it to, you know, have such an impact, you know, it's, you get one of those once in a career.
Yeah, like when Carol and I were thinking about, like, you know, cool movies. Literally, Pulp Fiction was on top of that. That was on top of be like, you know what's a cool movie that made you even feel cool to be watching it?
Yeah, just to watch it. Fiction. Even like, the soundtrack, cool. Too. Like, yeah. Just to listen to the music, you're like, I feel cool. I'm just, like, inputting it into my ears.
Yeah, I mean, so much of what it was about was cool.
Yeah.
Like, Quentin wrote this cool script about these things that he thought were cool. Hitmen are cool. Mm-hmm. Hitmen not actually killing people but talking about stuff in between killing people is incredibly cool.
Yeah.
You know? It's funny, though, because... just talking to folks, a young guy who had seen Pulp Fiction, and it occurred to me that anybody under 40 can't really appreciate Pulp Fiction the way that us old people can, mm-hmm. Because if you're younger and you watch Pulp Fiction now, it's like, wow, that's a great movie. And you think, okay, there are a lot of great movies. When you watched it in 1994, you're like, I've never seen anything like that before on a human screen.
Exactly.
Like, it changed the landscape. It's, you know, it was, it, like, if Hiroshima were, like, really a good thing, it would be Pulp Fiction.
It literally is before Pulp Fiction and after Pulp Fiction. That's how it was.
Yeah. The cinematic world was a different thing after that movie came out.
Because, like, after that was a bunch of movies trying to be like Pulp Fiction. I don't even know what people were trying to make before Pulp Fiction. It was like you have Scorsese and then Tarantino. That's what it was.
Right, right. It's funny because there were a couple of, you know, Unusual Suspects is a good movie, but without Pulp Fiction, Unusual Suspects never gets made.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know? But yeah, it's just... is wild to me that it still has cultural currency, it still has power, but you don't get the same thing. I guess it's sort of like, I listened to this podcast called You Must Remember This.
Okay.
And they talk about, you know, the forgotten or hidden or secret history of the first 100 years of Hollywood. And you'll listen to them talk about stars like John Garfield was the biggest star of the 1930s. He was a sex symbol. He was the biggest. I'm like, who?
Yeah.
And it's weird because there are certain things that stay in the culture. You're like, we know who Humphrey Bogart is,
yeah.
You know, but nobody knows who Paul Muni is anymore. But at the time, Muni was the bigger star and Bogart was like, yeah, he's like a wannabe Paul Muni, you know? And it's weird how there are, and I'm sure there will be people now that are huge stars, you know, Jonas Brothers, who 20 years from now, no, or like, actually, I'm sure there's a 13-year-old now who goes like, Joe Jonas had another band, you know?
Yeah, well, definitely, like, I'm a big fan of Honeymooners, which is, like, black and white,
right,
way
right.
back in the day, and I'm noticing people my age and younger have no idea who Jackie Gleason is.
Right!
And I'm like, what? How can you not know, like, at least, like, name value, Jackie Gleason?
Jackie Gleason, Milton
like,
Berle?
Like, he's great.
Like, people who were, like, you know, cultural signposts of the time. Somehow they just don't really translate for a new generation, and then they dissipate, they go away.
Well, who were your inspirations growing up? Did you have one single main inspiration, or did you have many that you remember?
I mean, I always used to say my favorite actor was Bugs Bunny.
Oh.
That's Carolyn's favorite actor.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
I love Bugs Bunny. Is half a joke and half truth.
It's true.
I mean, Bugs Bunny...
He's a real person to me.
As a character, mm-hmm. was amazing, you know? But then you stop and you break it down. It's like, oh, well, he's not an actor. He is a combination of the talents of an amazing group of people. You know, the Mel Blanks, the Chuck Jones, Frizz Freleng, you know, all of those, the Tex Avery, like all of those guys mm-hmm. who were part of building, you know? It's like, wow, if you could build Tom Hanks, Like, how many people would it take? And, like, how talented would they have to be to build Tom Hanks the
so
way
were
you build Bugs Bunny?
A big Mel Blanc fan with the voices?
No.
Okay.
I was a Bugs Bunny fan.
Okay. Did you even know of Mel Blanc?
I did know of Mel Blanc. Okay. But, you know, like, Sylvester wasn't that cool. You know, Sylvester and Tweety, I could do without. You know? And Roadrunner, the cartoons always annoyed me.
Okay.
You know? Because it was just, like, it's an exercise in frustration.
Yeah.
You know? But I did, as I got older, I certainly appreciated the skill and the talent. But, I mean, as I recognized for myself, I recognized that Mel Blanc wasn't it. He was part of it, you know? And, I mean, I always say that as voice actors, we are at best a third of the characters you love.
That's a really interesting perspective. I heard that Mel Blanc, when he used to do the carrot chomping, he would actually chomp carrots. Now, has there ever been a time when you've been recording audio where you've had to put something in your mouth? Or something
well,
that
worked,
you needed to
I worked in adult
create.
For several years, the hard years in the valley. No.
Was there any type of effect that you were trying to go for that you kind of had to do more than just a regular vocal interpretation?
Ooh, that's interesting. That's funny. Probably, I'm trying to think if there's anything specific I can remember. I mean, it's funny, I tend not to do much the vocal acrobatics. I mean, there are people I work with, like Billy West, Frank Welker, D. Bradley Baker, who can do things with their voices, make sounds that, like, a human being shouldn't be able to make.
Mm-hmm.
I just tend to do voices.
Okay.
Although, it's funny, because when we worked on Justice League, I was still early in my career, and we had a lot of action sequences. You know, there was, like, you know, throwing punches and swooping and being hit. And I thought, you know what? When I get really good at this, I'm going to be able to make a punching sound without actually having to, like, you know, move my body. Because I thought this is just me being an amateur. And now, 15 years into it, I'm like, no, there's not really, no, you can't do it. You could make the punching sound without going, ugh. But unless you actually move your body, it doesn't feel like you're making the right sound.
Yeah.
I feel like moving your body, that's like, you're still acting though, even though it's not visible in that case, but I feel like you need that to get whatever sound is inside of you to like, physically get that movement.
Well, I'm sure there are people who can do it without it, and or trust themselves. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. No, trust me, this is what it sounds like when my leg gets broken. You know? But with any actor, it's about your own process, you know, and how, I mean, that was one of the things about Pulp Fiction, watching Samuel L. Jackson, because the scenes, you know, in the apartment were mostly about him.
Yeah.
And the guy was incredible. It was, you know, because he was the nicest person in the world. You sit there and talk to him, he'd be drinking his coffee and talking about golf or whatever, and then they said, okay, it's time to go. When he walked on set, all of a sudden he just, like, transformed. The guy I was talking to, like, a minute ago was gone, and I'm looking into someone else's eyes.
You're looking into a bad mother ever's
eyes. Yes, yes. And I was just like, I mean, there was one point in the scene where he was supposed to, like, we had rehearsed it, where, he asks about the briefcase, and I start to say, it's over there. And he says, I don't remember asking you a goddamn thing. And he would look at me, and I would cower in the corner, and then he'd go back to Brett Whaley, Frank Whaley playing Brett. And he would start talking to Brett again. And when we were rolling, you know, I said my line, he turns to me and he yells, I don't remember asking you, and he's staring at me. And then he goes back and starts saying his lines to Brett, but he's still staring at me. And I'm just like, and I went completely out of my head. It's like, why is Sam still looking at me? and I literally began to get frightened. Like, did I do something wrong? What, is he mad? What? And like, so whatever fear you see on my face in that scene is real. You know.
You don't need to act when but you're around Samuel L.
Exactly, and the fact that he could go from just talking to being that guy and being instantly menacing without having to do any character work or stretches or anything. I mean, he can do that. Other people have to spend an hour getting into character. Mm-hmm. You know, it's whatever you require
to get you to the place you need to be. And I mean, it's all legitimate. So, although he's just much better at this.
So what is your process?
I'm really script oriented. For me, it's about reading the script, understanding the words, and understanding the writer's intention. You know, like, what part of the story, what are you trying to tell, and what is my part in telling your story? You know, once I figure that out, then, you know, I can, like, know what I'm supposed to do. I'm about being of service to the story, you know, which is hard, because a lot of times I'll lose a job to a stand-up comic, and then, like, and I realized, well, I went in there trying to do what they wanted. He went in and did what he wanted. Like, just do this. You know, like, I spent a lot of time doubling for Chris Rock in things that mm-hmm. they can't afford to keep him doing. And I realized, like, yeah, they hired Chris Rock to do Chris Rock. They're not asking him to, you know, delve into the character and reinterpret it. They just want him to sound like him. And bring all the things that you associate with that voice to that character, you know? And I'm like, oh, maybe I should do that. Maybe I should just come up with a persona and just jam that into everything. But that's not how I work.
Yeah. So before we get too far into the interview without mentioning Foster's Home, is one of my favorite animated shows.
Oh, yeah. It's like, oh, sorry that there's not any more. Is that okay? Sorry. You know, I love that show.
Yes.
Actually, Gray Delisle and I were both on that. It's one of like nine shows we've done together, she and I.
So do you have a relationship with Craig McCracken, or how does that work with the creator and?
Yeah, I mean, because Craig and Lauren Faust were mm-hmm. very hands-on with the show. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you don't actually get that good a relationship with the creator of an animated show, mm-hmm. because a lot of times they're artists and they're focusing on the art, and it's like they just need you to throw in the words. Like, did we get the words? Okay, good. And then they're gone, you know.
So they were pretty instrumental in everything?
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, it's funny because you don't think of it as a writer-driven show, just because it is so fun and, you know, fanciful, but they were very much about, and I think they wrote the majority of the episodes between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's not like they haven't been doing anything. Greg went off and did Wander Over Yonder, and Lauren went off and did My Little Pony.
Yeah.
Which a couple of people have heard of.
She totally revamped the brand.
Great job. Into something amazing.
Yes.
You know.
So speaking of like animation, when you're recording the voices, what's been the most amount of people in the studio that you've had to work in? Is it just usually one-on-one, or you usually have like four other people that you have to interact?
No.
Say if it was Justice League or something like that.
Justice League, we had some big records, because there were seven of us in the main cast, and then usually we would have, you know, at least three or four guests. And, you know, most of the time they would be there. So, yeah, I'd probably say Justice League were the biggest. I mean, Futurama, we did whole cast sessions all the time. So that was, what, seven or eight of us? Wait. Katie, John, Billy, Maurice, Tress, me, Dave. Yeah, seven.
That's a lot. Yeah. At that point, that's pretty much like a stage show in the studio.
Oh,
then.
Yeah, it's so much fun. But, I mean, the shows that are writing-driven, especially if they're comedy, they tend to want to hear the words together, you know, because you can jam it together in editing and make it work, but unless you hear the lines really, you know, bouncing off each other, you don't know if it truly works, especially for comedy. You know, I think the younger kids' cartoons where the comedy is not really comedy, it's just, that's funny. You know, they don't really care.
Wait, what is that?
That means if you have a character bug out its eyes or drop
like,
its pants.
Oh, it's like, yeah. Okay.
Like, I don't need to workshop that.
Yeah.
You know, a five-year-old will laugh if something mm-hmm. bugs out its eyes, you know.
Have you ever had a recording session where you're basically doing a conversation with yourself? Like, okay, we need you to do this one, and why are you here?
Actually, there was an episode of Static Shock while we were doing Justice League that they had Green Lantern cross over into Static City, into Dakota. And I really felt like Dwayne McDuffie and the other writers like, we're really like throwing down a gauntlet.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all right, let's see what you got.
Yeah.
Because it was me doing John Stewart Green Lantern, me doing Virgil as Static, and there was an evil John Stewart in the episode. That turns out at the end to be Sinestro. Spoiler alert! 17 years ago.
Too soon.
What? Was it 17?
No.
Oh, I was gonna be like,
I'm an actor, Joe. Don't make me do math. But yeah, that was a challenge. I'm like, okay.
Because one voice is here.
And the other voice is here.
I'm like, okay. I think I can do it. Let's not make it in the morning. Can we do that? But yeah, it was fun. It's always fun to be challenged like that, you know.
I was talking about theater before. I mean, is that something that you really thrive on too, the live atmosphere of being on a stage and performing?
Yeah. I was lucky enough a few years ago to get to do the Pee Wee Herman show on Broadway.
Yeah.
And
in LA.
Yeah.
We were there.
We went to
in LA?
Yes, we did. We went to LA to see that.
We went just to see that show.
Oh my God.
We did other things too.
It was so much fun.
It was great.
The experience of doing that for that audience. I mean, because it's one thing to just do a play, and I've done a lot of plays for very small audiences.
Yeah.
But it's another thing to do something that people are coming that they're in love with, mm-hmm. you know, and it's been amazing. It's funny because I. Taking the kids to see Hamilton in a couple of weeks, and I'm really curious to see, because I saw it once in October, we're going to see it again, and I'm curious to see what the feeling is in the audience, because when you're on stage you can feel the crowd, and you can feel if they're with you, and you can feel if they're in love with you. And when we were doing Pee Wee, you could feel, like, the curtain would open and you remember when you saw the Playhouse set?
Yeah.
And people go, there was like an audible intake of breath.
It's like, it's real. It's
happening. And no, you hear people get small. Like, people became seven, you know, again. And the hilarious thing was, people would come up to us after, and it's like, oh my God, the set is exactly how I remember it. Just like the show. It's like, it is exactly how you remember it. It's not at all like the show. Because I don't know if you remember, but the show itself was not shot on a stage. It was shot like a film.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had to translate that thing that people were used to seeing, like, on a moving camera in three dimensions into a flat stage. And they did it. They changed the colors. They changed the dimensions. They changed so many things, but kept all of the shape
door,
of the door.
Yeah.
The position of Cherry. They kept all of the things that mattered, how you remembered them, and then changed everything else so that it felt like you remembered it. Like, all of the colors were actually a little brighter than they used to be, you know? You didn't notice.
Well, it's funny, the day we went, I actually saw the original Cowboy Curtis in the hallway. And I was like, is that him? And I kept walking to the bathroom, because I was like on a roll, like walking to the bathroom, and I was like, man, I hope he's still there when I come back out, because I know that was him. And I just like walked right by him. But he was already gone, but I was like, dang. And then Christina Aguilera was also there.
Yes, I remember that day. Because Paul wouldn't tell me that Lawrence Fishburne was there. He waited until after the show to let me know that, it's like, oh, by the way, Lawrence Fishburne is here.
I love your impression of Paul Rubens.
And he could not have been nicer.
Do you think it would have haunted you to know that he was there? Or?
No.
Yeah.
He didn't fit those chaps anymore. And actually, I knew his wife. And I actually would have been excited to know that she was there.
Gina Torres.
Because Gina had guested on Justice League as Vixen.
That's right, yeah.
And
she's on Firefly. I know her from Firefly.
No, well, that's the thing. Everybody from Firefly guested on Justice League.
Okay.
Like, literally
everybody.
Because Bruce Timm loved the Joss Whedon world and wanted to bring that in, right?
Well, but I don't know any other Josh. He didn't bring anybody from Buffy, the show I was absolutely in love with.
That's true.
But he brought in everybody from Firefly.
Is it because he felt bad?
Well, you know what? I never asked him, because at the time I didn't watch Firefly, so I didn't recognize them. And I'm just like, oh, there's some really nice, talented people.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until later, I'm like, wait a minute. That guy Nathan was also on. Wait a minute, that guy Alan was on. Who's Marina Bakarin? Oh, damn!
I'm seeing the pattern.
It was their agent.
Right, exactly. Apparently their agent is Bruce Timm.
So can you tell me a little bit about Paul Rubens and what it's like to work with such a great mastermind that created a character? And you guys have a background in the Groundlings,
yeah,
is that
we
correct?
Both came out
did
of the
you,
Groundlings.
Did you know him back then?
No, he was in the Groundlings like 10, 15 years before me.
Okay.
But we had we had mutual friends, and we actually met doing a show at the Groundlings before the Pee Wee show, and that's part of the reason he hired me to do Cowboy Curtis. It was weird. It was sort of like working with Walt Disney and Mickey Mouse.
Love it.
You know what I mean? Because here's a guy who had created like a character that is literally an icon worldwide, but it's also the guy behind it. You know? I don't know. It's sort of it was interesting. And I asked him about it. It's like, did you? He's like, you know what? I never think about Pee Wee. I don't think about why it works. I don't think about what the appeal is. I don't try to figure it out in any way. I just do him. And he, you know, he does what he does. You know, and it's really interesting because in some ways they are separate.
Yeah.
It is, you know,
I think it's weird that he keeps it separate though. It's like if he was full on Pee Wee all the time, it's like you can't live life like that.
No. No.
Speaking of creating things, I would like to know about the room or the process of how Mad TV came about. Was it just one person was like, we need to do this?
No, I think that was a combination of lawyers, failed television execs. It was, I think, some guy who had the TV rights to Mad Magazine.
Yeah.
A couple of guys who had worked on In Living Color. And then this other producer who put them together. We had a lot of producers, half of whom I never saw, but I'm sure they got checks much bigger than mine.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I mean, they had a great eye for talent. All the people who ran that show brought in some amazingly talented people, but there was never any vision. And I think that, to me, is the biggest difference between it and Saturday Night Live, other than the fact that Saturday Night Live is a variety show and Mad TV was a sketch show like In Living Color. And there's a big difference between a variety show and a sketch show. Like, I'm gonna tune in to see Robert De Niro wear a wig.
Yeah.
Just cause, you know? I'm not tuning in for the sketches.
Yeah.
You know, I'm tuning in, it's like, oh my God, it's Robert De Niro.
See, Mad TV was like my first exposure to you, and I remember you doing like a UPS guy. I remember that jittery like delivery guy.
Yeah, no, totally, yeah, everybody, yeah, it was a guy.
And I knew your name back then. And it was funny because like I think it's because I was allowed to watch Mad TV, but I wasn't really allowed to watch In Living Color because my mom walked in on me when the Fly Girls were there, and I think she was like, "Oh no, you cannot watch this." And so she,
you
will
become a lesbian with a taste for Puerto Ricans.
It was like, because I remember the camera angle was like kind of going up,
right.
You know, and I was like, "Okay, well, I wasn't thinking like that. I was there for the comedy, but."
Mom, I'm not
like,
worried about objectification in the male gaze. I want to see the guy burn and set himself on fire again.
But yes, I definitely remember your delivery guy. That was my first Phil Lamar exposure.
That's funny. No, we got really...
Oh, Kim Possible. I heard a Kim Possible beat.
That mean it's time?
Does that mean it's time?
Oh, that's
time?
Your phone? That's my phone.
All right, guys. We do have 5 more minutes, so let's continue on.
No, I was going to say, the one thing that we had that was great... was we had producers from In Living Color and we had a producer-director from Kids in the Hall and SCTV, which is a fantastic, you know, combination. Like, so we had this sort of character-driven, deep-cut kind of clever comedy, plus this sort of raucous, in-your-face, dirty sort of energy. And the first two seasons, we were able to mix those together in a really cool way, plus the film parodies, which was part of Mad Magazine. And I think we actually, for those first 2 years, captured a spirit of the magazine in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Quite by accident.
You know, I wish there had been some, you know, person who said, you know what, if we take the character-based comedy of SCTV and the great ethnic mix of energy from In Living Color, we'd have something great. I think they just got who they got by accident. Because as the show went on, it became less that. And it became more about, well, what will 14-year-old boys laugh at? How about anal leakage? Let's just do a sketch about anal leakage.
It's like that's on a list. Funny.
We need to get
laugh.
This anal leakage in there somehow.
No, seriously, there was a list. No, it got to one point after I had left, I talked to a buddy who was writing on there, and then they were trying product placement. It's like, okay, guys, we've got a Toyota Yaris thing. Can we work that into a sketch? You know, but you can't make fun of the car at all.
No anal leakage.
No, and my buddy pitched a great idea. It's a Toyota Yaris. It's a John and a hooker in a Yaris. And, you know, like on the side of a street. Yeah. And she's extolling the virtues of the car. Like, oh, this will be great for us because the seat reclines all the way. And, you know, and they said, no. You can't have a hooker in the car. That's not a positive use of the product. Like, I don't know. They're selling the versions of the car, and that sounds funny as hell.
And 14-year-olds will love it.
14-year-olds love hookers. No, I guess not.
So. Okay, let's close this out by one last question. What advice would you give to somebody who is looking for a career in voice acting, or just acting in general at this point in 2016? And I'd like to know, like, you know, voice versus just regular trying to make yourself something in comedy, let's say.
That's an interesting question. I don't think, at least for me, there is a distinction. To me, saying you want to be a voice actor is like saying, I want to paint on the left side of the canvas. Like, what do you mean? Do you want to be a painter or not? Are you acting or not?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, no, I just really like this part. It's like, why would you limit yourself like that?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be an actor, you have to try to be an actor. There ain't enough jobs to just say, I'm only going to do voice work. You know, it's too hard a job to start out blocking yourself in. All that said, to do it in 2016, I have no idea. Everything has changed so much.
Definitely.
I mean, the revolution that killed the music industry opened up the voice world in a way that's indescribable. You know, now people can do voice work from, you know, Ohio to New York. And there's no difference between being on the other side of the country or being on the other side of a glass in a booth. It's the same thing. The bandwidth is all that's required. And with YouTube, I can't tell you how one would get started, because that's not the world I came up in. The only things I know that are still truths are, if you want to pursue a creative field, any sort of creative field, be it creative writing, performing, art, it's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult.
I can second that.
You know, because the things that you are judged on in terms of the work are not the same things that matter in terms of making a living necessarily. There is not necessarily a direct correlation. That said, one has to be self-motivated and self-driven, because there's always going to be an excuse not to do it because it's hard, because it's creative. There's always going to be a reason to do something else other than that. So you have to want it. You have to need it in a way that overrides those obstacles. You know, be it the inability to get a steady job, or just your mother saying, why are you still doing that? Come home. You know, you have to be able to drive yourself through or over those hills to do it. And I think that part of it is still true. Unless a big producer sees your YouTube channel and makes you famous instantly. Justin Bieber.
He still put himself out there, though, to, like, get noticed.
Yeah, a year at 15?
I mean, Usher
can you imagine if you were just, like, drawn for a year
And then someone said, hey, you're a star.
I guess that's what Usher did. Usher's like, hey, little boy, I can make you into something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the downside is you don't get to train. You don't get to test your own personal mettle and figure out who you are as a person before everybody is looking at you. And it tends to make you an a-hole.
Yeah,
that's why Justin has no more friends. You watch the documentary, it's like, my friends are my security guards.
Yeah, he has like his security guards playing basketball with him.
That's what I'm talking about.
When he really should get Wilt.
That's right, he needs an imaginary friend.
Yes. All right, thank you so much, Phil, for joining us. And thanks for your advice.
For letting me ramble.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everybody, for coming.
And there you have it. And there you have it. The Carolyn and Joe Show live with Phil Amar at AwesomeCon 2016. That was me. That was Carolyn. And with Phil Amar, our voices made an awesome show.
Of course, Phil very graciously got to do some awesome impersonations while he was there.
It was really cool that we actually had like that slow clap at the beginning of that.
Yeah.
That was amazing. That was pretty amazing.
It was crazy because he actually did, like, at that time I wasn't checking my Twitter. I was like getting ready to do a show, but he really did tweet me. He tweeted like, I'm on my way or something.
It's sort of insane to think that like he took that time.
I'm like, dude, just come up here.
Yeah. It took that time like on from, you know, doing meeting fans, doing you know, talking and voices photos with fans over at his booth and doing autographs and photos, to in between that time to go on his social media on his phone or whatever and say, I'm on my way, just like in the spirit, I'm on my way. I really had a good time. Did you have a good time?
Yeah, it was great, Phil. I mean, if we could do one every year, it would be great. I mean, even if we interview Phil again, I would be up for it. I mean, he's just a guy that I feel like you could talk to for a long time. Didn't feel stale. It was good.
It's really sort of crazy to think that, like, you know, what if we do just keep on adding, it's Phil, and then we just add another person until, like, it's this big committee of the Carolyn and Joe Show live in front of these people, and we just, like, tear the house down.
Yeah, yeah. So last year on our podcast, we should mention, we did interview Amber Benson, better known also as Tara from Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
That's right.
And she also does her own films and stuff. So if you guys are inclined to look in the archives and dig a little bit, you can find that if you're into like our AwesomeCon interviews. We've also interviewed several people from The Walking Dead. So you can look for those in previous years of AwesomeCon, because we've done interviews every single year. So it's been fun. It's been a great time. And again, we'd like to thank AwesomeCon, Ben and Becky, and all the volunteers. It's just been a great show, and this year's had so much energy in addition to like all the other previous years. It just keeps getting better and better, and the energy is still riding. I mean, it's only been a week now since our interview with Phil, and I guess close to a week, not a full week exactly, but you know, relatively a week, and I still feel the energy in the room, so it's pretty awesome to carry that over for several days afterwards. So.
Yeah,
and we can only thank Phil for that, because he is awesome. And I love his voices, and I love his talent. He's a great guy.
And I love that we got to talk about Spider-Man 2.
Definitely. I mean, like,
And Pulp Fiction and all that. But
Spider-Man
2.
I was seriously like, is that Bill Maher?
Who knew that we were going to talk about Spider-Man with Phil Lamar? We got deep. We went deep into sci-fi and comics with Phil Lamar.
Yeah.
Deep, man. Hopefully you guys enjoyed that conversation that you probably, I don't know if you're ever going to hear that anywhere else, but hopefully that's why you come to the Carolyn Joe Show. You hear a conversation that you'll never, ever hear ever else. But just so you guys know, next week, the early half, you're going to hear, you know, the normal, there's nothing never normal, but like Carolyn and Joe Show, hopefully we got
the regular scheduled
one. You're going to have a guest, but in the meantime, keep on voting to see who you want to hear next. We'll get you that list. It could be, you know, Will Friedle. It could be Summer. Whatever you guys want to have.
Gray Delisle.
Whatever you guys want, let us know. But the first part of the week is going to be us with maybe a mystery guest. Who could it be? And then we're going to roll out more AwesomeCon panels, because I know you guys enjoy that. Right? So again,
crickets. But I guess I'll say, yeah, I enjoy it.
Yeah. Sure. But also, just so you know, this show is again brought to you by Straight Productions, straightproductions.com. Check out my work, joecarabeo.com, one-shots.com, gostray.tumblr.com, mondaymistress.com, where we have a whole bunch of shows at early July. Check them out. Check out Carolyn's work, carolynblefsky.com, curls-studio.com. Put a slash on it. Check out Curls. You know, that's what it is. Stray J, at Carolyn Belefsky.
And if you don't know about Phil Lamar, you can certainly Google him and find out all that information.
Absolutely. So again, my name is Joe.
And I'm Carolyn.
Be excellent to each other. Let him know, Carolyn.
You're bona fide.